the Redskins. Hail victory! Praise on the warpath. Fight for all we see.
Green driven back to midfield on the far side. He's got the ball up to the 45, far side 40. A seam to the 35. Waltz a man to the 30. Breaks it to the near side 25. Watch out to the 20. Near side 10. He's gone. Touchdown, Washington Redskins.
This is Burgundy and Gold Flashback. Now, here's Mike Richmond.
You are listening to Burgundy and Gold Flashback, where the tradition of a storied NFL franchise, the Washington Redskins, stays alive. I'm Mike Richmond, author of the Redskins Encyclopedia and the Washington Redskins Football Vault. My website is redskinshistorian.com. That's redskinshistorian.com. My guest was a key figure in the Redskins' glory run in the 1980s. A tight end, he earned two Super Bowl rings in his seven seasons in D.C., 1981 to 87. Overall, he caught 141 passes for 1,923 yards with 21 TDs in his nine-year NFL career. On the phone with me now from Pasco, Washington, Clint Didier. Clint, thanks for coming on the show.
Mike, it's my pleasure. It's great to be back in touch with those Washington people back there in D.C., being from the Washington state here. I'm in a double quandary here, Washington.
Well, the Washington, D.C. That we know of, we're in our own quandary here regarding the Washington Redskins, and I'll be looking to you for some answers and solutions to what's going on. But first, I know that you're heavily involved in politics, and you just ran for Congress in Washington's 4th District, and you lost in a cliffhanger to a fellow Republican. I definitely want to talk to you considerably about that. We'll do that later in the interview. Regarding the current team, though, I know you've got some great thoughts on what's going on, and they're currently 3-10 after a 24-0 loss to the Rams, or on a 5-game losing streak. Five double-digit losing seasons in the past 6 years. They're assured of that. They've had only 4 playoff appearances in the 16 seasons since Dan Snyder purchased the team. So tell me, what is ailing the Washington Redskins?
Well, presently, it's confidence. They're searching for it right now. When I played for the Redskins, the very first year I was on injured reserve because I had a bad hamstring pull and was trying to get healed up, but we went through a pretty tough time at the very start of Joe Gibbs' era. We were 0-5, and now you hear all the rumors that Joe Theismann was on the trading block and Joe Gibbs' job was in jeopardy. And you know, it was when we finally found our rhythm that we started winning. We bought into the Joe Gibbs offense. We had a great running back in the name of John Riggins that really basically packed us to that first Super Bowl. But once we got our winning ways going, it was tough to stop us. We had some great years. We had a great nucleus of guys that believed in one another. None of us were big-name players except for the likes of John Riggins and Joe Theismann and probably Dave Butts. But the other rest of us were just blue-collar workers. And we loved our job. We loved football. And we believed in one another, and that's what you got to have. More than anything else, you got to have a team that believes in one another. But the one thing that I will say, and I do like Dan Snyder. He's a good man. He's a conservative. I like him a lot because of that. But the one thing, if I could just inject a little bit of wisdom that I learned from Jack Kent Cook and Joe Gibbs, was Jack Kent Cook hired Joe Gibbs and he says, go get him, and he left him alone. And I was terribly troubled this last job interview that Russ Grimm, a fellow teammate of mine, put in for that and didn't even get interviewed. I would really have liked to have seen Russ Grimm and what he could have done with that Redskin organization and getting them back to a winning team and making the D.C. people proud once again.
Well, I know his name has come up often with NFL openings, or at least speculation that Russ Grimm could could fill that position, but he's never gotten an NFL head coaching job, and you know, a lot of people have wondered about that. Here we have a charter member of the Hogs. He's in the Pro Football Hall of Fame. He's been an offensive line coach, including with the Redskins. So why would he not make a really good head coach? It's just something that a lot of people have been confused about over the years.
He was also an integral part. He was the assistant head coach for the Arizona Cardinals when they went to the Super Bowl. Prior to that, he was the offensive line coach for the Pittsburgh Steelers when they went to the Super Bowl. This man is nothing but success and winning. And, boy, I tell you what, whoever gives him the opportunity might be reaping the rewards of a very successful person in football.
So do you think then that Dan Snyder has taken the wrong direction with this in hiring people such as Jay Gruden and Mike Shanahan in recent years?
No, I wouldn't say that. I just don't think that it's obviously not working out at the present time. I wouldn't say that. I know that John Gruden, his brother, I really admired him as a spectator out and away from the game, his intensity and his love of the game. But I would say his brother has all of that too. But it's the chemistry, and obviously the chemistry's not there right now. But I would say as far as RG3 is a fine young man, a great athlete. And if I had to say anything about RG3's career is that it was in jeopardy when Shanahan played him in that playoff game. He should have never played him. Kirk Cousins should have started that game and played that game and let RG3 get healthy. Because the one thing any young athlete will do, he'll play hurt because they love the game, they love to play, and they want to show everybody how tough they are. And it's just too bad they couldn't allow him to get healthy before he tore that knee all up that night in that playoff game.
Well, two questions regarding that. First, was that entirely Mike Shanahan's fault that he ended up playing in that playoff game? And I ask that because does a player have his responsibility to look out for his teammates and think, hey, you know, I am not 100% healthy. Maybe I should sit myself down.
Well,
could that have played into this?
Well, I would have to say this: who is the man in charge? And obviously, the number one man in charge is the owner. That's Dan Snyder. Now, did he make the call? We don't know. But the head coach makes the call. And I knew this with Joe Gibbs, that when he said, we're going to go this way because we don't want to further your injury, we don't want to jeopardize your career. And yes, playoff games are important, but look what's happened to RG3. He's not the player that he was, and it was because that night you watched that leg. That thing was going in contortions it was never meant to go in, and he was just tearing up meniscus, ligaments. He further injured that knee to the point where it probably jeopardized his career.
Well, do you think then that after the injury that RG3 suffered in the Ravens game that season, that was the late-season game that the Redskins pulled out, and that was the very serious knee injury, that the Redskins should have actually shut him down for the season?
Probably, because Kirk Cousins had won two games. He had showed his ability to win. And honestly, looking back, I would think it would have been the smarter choice, because RG3 is not the player he once was. They're not even running the same type of plays, the dive option that he was so successful running, because he doesn't have the acceleration. He's wearing a knee brace now constantly and continually. And I would say, looking back on it, yes, I think it would have been better to let him sit and rest and heal.
Have you heard the criticism in recent days from people like Fran Tarkenton and Shannon Sharp regarding RG3? They're just questioning his commitment to the game. They're saying that he's not suited to be a pocket passer in the NFL. Have you heard any of that criticism? And if so, what is your opinion about that?
I only heard Tarkenton, and it's easy for one to criticize, but I got to say that RG3 has a heart. He has a big heart. He's a competitor, and I wouldn't sell this guy short on anything. I think anybody, he could develop into a pocket passer. That wasn't his forte. He was not a pocket passer when he came into the league, and who knows what he could develop into, but it does take will. It takes want to, and I'm sure that he does have that. I know that he is a fine young man. I have heard him speak. He is very well spoken. He's very smart, and I love his belief in God. I believe, and I love that he believes in himself. And I think that to take and say that he is not able to succeed is being very hypocritical right now. And I think the man could succeed at anything he wants to succeed at, as long as he pursues it with a passion.
Mm-hmm. You know, he has aspirations of someday getting into politics himself.
He would be a fine representative because he believes in our Constitution. And I think more importantly, he believes in a limited government. And right now, this government, we weren't going to get into politics this early, but it's micromanaging everyone's lives. And that's what's great about America, is America is freedom, where you live your life in freedom, free of choices. Mm-hmm. And our government is micromanaging everyone's lives.
Just let me get back to Jay Gruden for a second before we go to break. I wanted to ask you, the Redskins are... they could very well finish 3-13 this season. It would be their second straight 3-13 year. And given Gruden's situation, though, if that happens, if they lose three more games, they will have lost eight in a row by season's end. Should the Redskins be looking for another coach in the offseason, or should this continue to be Jay Gruden's team?
Boy, that's more than I can answer right now. I think that's up to the owner. He's the one that's got all the money on the line. It's his call. The only advice I'd offer the owner is, once you hire a coach, let them decide who plays. Let them decide on the logistics of the game, and be more of a Jack Kent Cook owner. And that's just let them do their thing. And if they don't succeed, then you get somebody else. And if they do, you knew what you were doing when you hired them.
Well, I've heard that analogy regarding Jack Kent Cook and how he did, you know, remain behind the scenes and let Bobby Beathard and Joe Gibbs do their thing.
Well, you know, that was the whole thing. I remember Joe Gibbs came out to Portland State, where I played my college football, and he asked Neil Lomax to work out for him, and I just happened to be there when Neil said, whenever somebody shows up, give me a call, and I'll come catch the footballs for you.
Need to go to break right now, and here's This Week in Redskins History.
Hey, it's Mike Richmond, the official Redskins historian and author of the Washington Redskins Football Vault and the Redskins Encyclopedia. From the pages of my books comes This Week in Redskins History. On December 13th, 1970, second-year running back Larry Brown rushed for 85 yards in a win over the Eagles to become the first Redskin to gain at least 1,000 yards in a season. After he topped the 1,000-yard mark, the 45,000 fans at RFK Stadium gave him a standing ovation as he walked off the field flashing a V sign. He ran for an NFL-best 1,125 yards that season, breaking the Skins' single-season mark of 951 set by Rob Good in 1951, and he earned Pro Bowl and consensus All-Pro honors. Brown played eight seasons in D.C., posting another 1,000-yard season in 1972, and is today one of the Redskins' all-time leading rushers. For more on Redskins history, check out my website at RedskinsHistorian.com. That's RedskinsHistorian.com. I'm Mike Richmond for This Week in Redskins History.
Welcome back to Burgundy and Gold Flashback. I'm Redskins historian Mike Richmond, back with former Redskins tight end Clint Didier, who wears two Super Bowl rings from the Redskins' glory years in the 1980s. Clint, thanks again for coming on the show.
My pleasure, Mike.
Great. So, you played your college ball at Portland State, originally from Washington State, and you were a wide receiver at Portland State, correct?
Yes, I was. As I grew in high school, I was a wide receiver because there's not many other positions I could have played at 6'4", 167 pounds. I was voted most likely to be broken in half on the football field. But as I got into junior college football at CBC, and then I went on to play at Portland State, I hit the weight room and started developing and putting on weight. And it was there that Joe Gibbs came to work out Neil Lomax. And I told Neil to give me a call whenever anybody came through. He called me up and said, hey, this new coach from the Redskins is coming to work me out. Would you mind coming and catching the balls? And I said, absolutely, I'll be right there. That day I happened to catch just about everything he threw. I was diving for passes and caught everything when we got done catching the balls. Neil said, well, Coach Gibbs, you want me to run a 40? And he says, no, Neil, I'm done with you, but Clint, I'll let you run a couple 40s. And I found out later when he got to the airport, he tried to call Bobby Beathard 7 times. And finally, Bobby answered the phone and, yeah, Joe, what's up? He goes, what's, is Neil that good? And he goes, no, who's this Didier guy? And he goes, Didier? Who? He goes, Clint Didier. He goes, I don't even know who you're talking about. He goes, well, look on your sheet. You got to have some info on him. And he looked him up, and he says, yeah, he's a slow white guy. What do you want this guy for? And he goes, he's going to be my next H-back. So Joe Gibbs obviously seen a diamond in the rough, and it was my avenue to get on the Redskins. And, of course, the first year of an injured reserve allowed me the time to learn the running game, a tiny position, and all the ins and outs of playing a tight end, the running game, and then the dog and blitz adjustments that you got to learn in his offense. And that first year being on IR was really what enabled me to make the team and be part of that great Redskin team.
So you did not play at all in the 1981 season then?
No, they were talking about trying to bring me across the waiver wire, but they were afraid they were going to lose me because Minnesota had been at the Portland State facility 3 times. They worked me out, and they kept telling me, don't tell anybody we were here. We're going to draft you in the 12th round. Well, the Redskins had 3 picks before the Vikings, and they knew that if they put me across that waiver wire, that Minnesota was probably going to grab me up.
Now, regarding the 1981 draft, which you just alluded to being picked in the 12th round, I mean, that was the greatest draft in Redskins history. In the first round, the Redskins selected Mark May. 3rd round, Russ Grimm. 5th round, Dexter Manley. 8th, Charlie Brown. 9th, Darryl Grant. And then you went in the 12th. And then Joe Jacoby, of course, was signed as a free agent that year. And so there you have 3 members of the Hogs. So a lot of that was Bobby Beathard. He was the architect behind that great draft. Tell me about him. How great a general manager was he?
Well, he obviously seen talent, but there was also some others in that draft that you have failed to mention, and one of them was Mel Kaufman. He was a linebacker I played against out here at Cal Poly SLO, and Mel Kaufman was a great linebacker for us. You know, he never made the all team, neither did I, but we had a lot of players that were just solid blue-collar players that loved to work, that loved to compete, and were part of that very successful team. But Bobby Beathard was a man that could see talent. And then, of course, well, Bobby didn't find me. I already told you the story about Joe Gibbs, but I think the two of them worked very good together on just seeing talent and seeing how they could play a part in the offense and defense that they had in mind for the Redskins to run. And then also a big component of the game was special teams. And Wayne Sevier was a great coach, and he utilized all that talent also to make our special teams one of the best in the NFL, because there are 3 phases to a game, and all 3 phases of those game have to be strong or else you will lose.
Do you think, though, that Bobby Beathard is Hall of Fame material? Could he be seriously considered for the Pro Football Hall of Fame?
Yes, because I think Bobby Beathard has had success besides the Redskins. He was also very good. I believe he was at San Diego. And I think that team that he was the GM there for reached the Super Bowl, did they not?
They did.
Yes, and so he has had success elsewhere. I think Bobby Beathard is just a pretty calm, cool, and collected personnel that could go out and see talent, and more importantly, see an individual for his inner qualities, and that is that he wasn't going to be a problem for the team, that he was a team player, he was a class act, and he wouldn't put that team in jeopardy as far as an embarrassment off the field.
Mm-hmm. What about Joe Gibbs? You had the honor of playing for him, genius when it came to offensive creativity. Tell me about that. Regarding him.
I think you're right. He is. It was very passionate. You could see it in his game plan prep and delivery to the personnel in the room of how he would deliver and implement a game plan. But more importantly, I think Joe Gibbs, every time I went to speak to him, when I went into his office, either he summoned me or I went in to talk to him on one of the matters that was concerning me, he always stepped away from his desk, and on that desk he always had his Bible open, and he was reading his Bible. Now, one thing people don't realize is Joe Gibbs, I never heard one time that he say a swear word. He never cussed. The only thing we ever heard him say was Bunsy. We're going to kick their buns. So behind the scenes, we nicknamed him Bunsy. We never said it to him, to his face, but that was just out of a token that we loved that guy. He was, we would put it on the line for him because he was a man, a class act man. And here's the thing, he was a humble man too, because he loved to throw the ball. He came from Air Coryell. But he realized that he thought he had an egomaniac on his hands with John Riggins, but then when he seen how John was such a durable, determined, powerful back, he implemented the game plan around that. He was humble because he didn't put the ball in the air as much as he wanted to. He relied on a running game, and there formulated the Hogs. And you take a man that loved to throw the ball and implement a ground game that really opened up the play-action pass. The man was he was committed to winning, and that's one of the things that I'll never forget is he was always passionate on his delivery of the game plan, very well thought out. In fact, you very seldom found anything that he had forgotten to cover as far as safety, blitzes, corner fires, dogs, you name it. He covered everything in the plan when he implemented it.
Now, he was meticulous with his game plans and preparation. But what was it like playing in his schemes where he had these really, unique formations, like the bunch formation where the receivers went in all different directions, and it just confused the defensive backs? What was it like for you?
Well, it was tiring for me because usually on those formations and in a lot of the movements before the ball was snapped, the H-back was the one that went in motion. And there were times where I was running completely across the formation before the ball was snapped. And that's the H-back did a lot of movement, as did the Z receiver. And then the tight end would do some too. But the H-back is the one that did a lot of motion, a lot of shifting, and it was very tiring. And let me tell you, you got to be a student of the game. You cannot be, and that's why I always emphasize to the young kids out there that want to be professional football players, I emphasize the fact they got to get their education, because you cannot be somebody that doesn't comprehend and execute well, because you have learning impairments. You got to be able to learn an offense and go out there that same day and execute it, because they demanded it. I remember one player that got too confused, and he grabbed his helmet on a motion because he was unsure of where he was supposed to go, and he said he goes, "I'm so confused." The next day he was gone. Now you had to be able to grab a hold of that game plan and go out and execute it on a day's notice. And so you can't be a dumb player in the NFL. You have to be smart, and that's why you got to use those educational skills of being able to comprehend and log away and then recall when you need it out on the field.
Mm-hmm. Before we get to more of your political career, I just want to ask you about the fact you started only 39 games in your career, but you were such a clutch receiver in Super Bowl 18, for instance. Granted, it was a 38-9 loss to the Raiders, but you were the Redskins' leading receiver in that game with 5 catches for 65 yards. And then in the 1988 postseason, in the first playoff game against the Bears, the 21-17 Redskins win, you caught an 18-yard touchdown pass from Doug Williams in the second quarter that tied the game at 14. And then in the Super Bowl itself, you were part of that 35-point second quarter explosion. You caught an 8-yard touchdown pass from Williams that capped that 35-point run. What was going through your mind as that lead was building?
Well, when we first started off the game, people remember it was 10-0, and they just kicked off to us. They had scored a touchdown, a field goal, and they kicked off to us, and Ricky Sanders had fumbled the ball. And I remember watching the game film, and there was a pile of guys, and Ricky was standing outside the pile, and he was looking into the pile, and he was the guy packing the ball. Next thing you see him dive into the pile, and he comes out with the football. I think he knew that he better find that football and get it, or else don't come back to the sidelines. But it was 10-0, and it was not looking good for the Redskins that day. And then all of a sudden that second quarter busted loose, and the next thing we know it was 35 points in one quarter. And heck, it's something for a team to score 35 points in a half, let alone in a quarter. five touchdowns, and it was just incredible moment to be part of that great explosion of offense that will never be forgotten. But to be blessed with that touchdown pass from Doug Williams, and do you realize that that's the only time in Super Bowl history that a black quarterback threw a white guy a touchdown in a Super Bowl? The country was united. Our president was Ronald Reagan. And if you remember, our country was united. There was none of this racial divide right now. There was none of this pitting races or ethnicities or the rich against the poor or the public against the private. We were united as a country. We were a very strong country at that time because everybody, they seen good in everyone else. We were a great team, and that was the first time that a black quarterback had started in the Super Bowl, and what an honor to catch the only touchdown pass in a Super Bowl, and it was from Doug Williams. And I have the football here sitting right behind me on my trophy shelf, and I'll never ever let go of that football. That is one football that I'll always hang on to.
I can understand why you treasure that football. And he was, of course, named the MVP of that game.
In fact, do you realize that was the last football game that I played it for the Redskins was Super Bowl 22?
Yes, you left the Redskins after the 87 season.
Went to Green Bay and played 2 years for them and then retired.
Mm-hmm. And now you're immersed, of course, in politics. And I mentioned that recently lost to fellow Republican Dan Newhouse in the race for the congressional seat in Washington's 4th District. And you were also a candidate for the U.S. Senate in the 2010 midterm elections. Is that correct?
Yes, because I see what's happening with America, and it's on the decline. We're losing our personal liberties. The truths of our Constitution, and more importantly, our Declaration, when it says that these unalienable rights of life, and that's innocent human life, and the abortion that are being performed today in our country is horrible. We are destroying God's gift, and that is human life, and that troubles me because they said our tax dollars would not be paying for it. But the last continuing resolution, the bill they passed for the war when they invaded over, I can't remember the country that they went into, but they passed that bill, and that bill funded Planned Parenthood, which kills babies. And then liberty, our individual liberty, we're losing it. Here in our own state, we just passed an initiative that if we were going out to a range to shoot and I handed you my rifle to try out, we could be arrested for a Class C felony, which is a transfer of weapons. If we don't have the paperwork filled out to transfer that weapon from one person to another, we could be arrested. The liberties of the individual liberties, we're losing it at a rapid pace. And the pursuit of happiness, private property rights, is under attack by all these agencies. The second half of our Declaration, one of the usurpations that our founders laid against the king was he has erected a multitude of new offices, sent out his hither swarm of officers to harass our people and to eat out their substance. And if that's not what's going on today in America, these agencies, the EPA, all these agencies that they've created, and a lot of them are created by executive orders, which don't give them the jurisdiction over the American people that they so claim they have. And so, therefore, we are being undermined by these agencies and our private property rights. They're taking our rights to own property. I'm never going to quit fighting for this because my children, and I have three grandchildren, and if they're going to live the American dream, we have to keep America a sovereign nation. And I see so many of these career politicians are leaning more and more towards this one-world government, a one-world currency, where American exceptionalism will no longer be, and therefore the American dream will be gone. And I want our kids to have that shot at the American dream, and the only way that's going to happen is by keeping America a sovereign nation, and to keep it to where we hold on to our individual liberties granted to us in the Constitution. and that is life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness are unalienable rights granted to us by God, not by a government or by individuals of a government, but by God.
So what's next for you on the political front? Are you going to run for governor?
No, I don't know what's in store. Right now, I'm just getting my feet back underneath me because, like you said, it was a nail biter. My opponent ran negative ads against me. He never said what he was going to do. He only put fear in the people's heart that I was going to take away their Social Security, I was going to take away their Medicare, I was going to take away the veterans' health care. He just ran negative ads, somewhat to what the Democrats have done, and he claims to be a conservative. Planning on maybe a radio show here that we're going to start up in the first of the year, and then also a PAC. I'm going to create the Washington Patriots PAC. We're in the stages of putting this together to create an avenue to raise money for constitutional conservative candidates so I can help other people that are strong on the Constitution, on individual liberty, on life, and the pursuit of happiness, help them get into office and try to make a difference that way. I don't know what's in store for me as far as running for office. This last one really put a sour taste in my mouth. My own Republican Party sort of backstabbed me, and pretty upset about it. So I'm just going to heal up here and see what happens.
Well, Clint, I want to thank you again very much for coming on Burgundy and Gold Flashback, and I hope that you come to the D.C. area for some Redskins alumni events, and if so, I would love to chat with you while you're there.
You bet, Mike. I hope to get there. I was hoping to be there as a congressman. I was going to get back there and attend a few games and stuff, but it is quite a lengthy travel for me to come back there for the alumni events. I'd love to be there. I'd love to say hi to a lot of the fans, but it's as far as you can get away from D.C.
And many thanks to my audience for listening to Burgundy and Gold Flashback, and thanks to my producer, Mike Engel, for his work running the board. I'm Mike Richman. My website is RedskinsHistorian.com. That's RedskinsHistorian.com. For now, hail to the Redskins.